Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong, it's bringing mercy. It won't be long. Healing rain is coming down. It's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy and tears of shame are washed forever in Jesus' name.
Good morning. Welcome to The Cross in the Desert. Right here, we are speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. So glad to welcome you to the Thursday edition of my program. A very incredible, talented lady is going to be my guest today. Her name is Zainab Khan. You might remember her if you've seen the powerful documentary, Honor Diaries. She was also in that along with many, many other activists. She's a very talented, gifted lady. She's a visual artist and mixes activism with her art. We're going to talk about that later. And she always stands up for the rights of women. We're going to be talking today about some subjects in the field of women's rights, in the field of gender equality, in the field of how women are treated in the Middle East, mainly in the Asian community. She's a licensed therapist. And she deals with those that are victims of, I think, lots of violence and mistreatment, psychological and physical torture as well. Of course, if you've seen the movie Honor Diaries, the documentary talks about honor killings, female genital mutilation, and other situations where women are victims of just abusive, gross mistreatment in Muslim-controlled countries. Many, many Muslims in this film standing up and speaking out against these atrocities, very courageous ladies. And one of them is going to be my guest today. Her name is Zainab Khan, and we will talk with her later about her role in Honor Diaries. We're going to talk about what we can do to change some of the laws in these countries that are oppressive to women. Zainab does a lot of public speaking besides her artwork, and she speaks out in behalf of women all over the world and speaks about their rights and talking about education, what we can do to inform the community, what we can do to change the laws, what we can do to educate people about what's happening to women. October actually is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And, of course, that's dealing with domestic violence. Zainab is going to be talking about a different kind of violence, although related. It's honor-based violence. We're going to be talking about that later at 10 a.m. You definitely want to hear what she has to say. Well, this is really a difficult day for me and many, many other human rights activists. I want to tell you it's really difficult to talk about this because all of us have been so committed to speaking out for Rehana Jabari. Rehana Jabari is a 26-year-old young lady in prison in Iran. She is going to be executed because she defended herself against a rapist more than 7 years ago. And in that defense, she stabbed him, and subsequently he died of his injuries. The travesty of this trial is that there was another man there, as she claims, that really killed this man, that she had left, ran out the door, of course, in fear for being sexually assaulted. And as she ran out the door, Rehana recalls, there was another man there. because she's a woman, because they don't believe much of the testimony of women in Iran, and because this man was a former intelligence agent for Iran. She has been mistreated. She has been abused, and she's not being heard. Her story has not been told in court. It was a travesty, this whole trial. Rouhana has suffered on death row for many, many years, and we as human rights activists have worked very, very hard to make the internet community aware of her plight for freedom and had many, many people to sign the petition. And I just want to bring you up to date exactly what is going on. I go to the We Are Rouhana International page. Her mother, Sholi Pakravan, is just devastated. And here's what happened. In Iran, before a victim, I call Rouhana a victim, before she is executed, there is a tradition, I guess I can call it, where the two families are brought together. And Rouhana can receive forgiveness or pardon from the family. And if the family should pardon her, and then she would be free. In this case, the Sarbandi family refused to pardon her. I want to read to you the statement on the We Are Rouhana International page and bring you up to date. It says, "With great regret, we inform you that Rouhana has not been pardoned. She is now in grave danger. The final meeting was conducted today. Jalal Sarbandi demands retribution on behalf of his family. At the meeting today, Jalal Sarbandi was accompanied by two unknown bearded men. When Jalal spoke his final words and insisted on retribution, Sholi Pakravan, that's Rouhana's mother, cried and screamed. It was just awful. She begged and begged for her daughter's life. However, the two bearded men calmly advised Jalal not to be influenced by this. It is of great concern that these two unknown men were allowed to attend the meeting and sit on either side of Jalal and tell him to not forgive. We believe they were sent by the same authority who was trying to cover up their crimes by getting rid of Rouhana. No doubt they were sent to intimidate Jalal and his family and ensure that they do not pardon Rouhana. Any human being would have been moved by Rehana's mother and the letters written by thousands of people begging for forgiveness. This only means that the Sarbandi family is also under pressure from certain government authorities, such as the intelligence service. Rouhana could be executed at any moment now. Sholi Pakravam has become silent since the meetings began. The international community owes it to her and her family to step up and speak louder, put more pressure on the Iranian government, and demand Rouhana to be released immediately. We will be organizing protests once again." I want you to hear the response of Rouhana's mother on her Facebook page that was translated. Rouhana's mother is Sholi Pakravan. She posted three messages today. In the first message, she spoke of how valuable life is. The second message is posted and translated for you here. "Over the last couple of days, two peace and reconciliation meetings were held at the public prosecutor's office. Mr. Sarbandi attended both meetings on behalf of the deceased's family. Rouhana was brought to court yesterday with security, and I got to kiss her again when she arrived and once when she left. She was in handcuffs throughout the meeting, but that did not stop me from kissing her. Despite all my efforts and tears and pleas and beggings, Mr. Sarbandi said they do not think about forgiveness. I trust my Rouhana in God's hands, and I surrender to destiny. Although I will not give up the fight until the end, I put my trust in God and with his permission. That God's blessings be upon both families. The pain that we endure is horrific. We both need to have a messianic moment in order to pass these crises safely. Both families are in need of sincere prayers. Pray for us." I thought it was beautiful that Sholi said that she prayed for the deceased family, and that she's mentioning them, that they too need prayers. What a wonderful, courageous, loving woman to have said that, in spite of the fact that they refuse to forgive her daughter. Also on the international page was another story. I found this amazing. I have to share it with you. This is from Rehana's old classmate. Her name is Yasmin. She says, "My name is Yasmin, but it could have been Rehana. I am 27 years old, and I live in London with my family, but I could have been withering in Shayar Ray prison, separated from my family's nest and their warmth." Yasmin writes, "I once studied in a classroom with Rehana. Pine green uniforms, three rows of benches, and a chalkboard. We were 12 or 13 years old. She was bright, lovely, and loved performing on stage. I have come to know that she took these qualities mainly, brave Mother Sholi. We sang in the school's choir together and performed in religious plays, quote, the only type that existed at school in those days. I moved to England. She moved to another school. I heard of her no more until," and then she writes, "I am now a criminal defense lawyer, but I could have been a convict, truth be told, a victim." The irony. "I spent the best years of my youth at university and bar school free. I could have been spending those years in a cell, enduring physical and mental torture, confined. My life ran exactly parallel to Rehana's, but in the opposite direction. The main difference is that I live in a country where at least the most basic human rights are observed. The right to life, the right to a fair trial, and the right to be protected from torture or inhumane and degrading treatment or punishment. Been Rehana. You could have been Rehana's mother. You could have been Rehana's family or friends. Compare your life. Will you stop taking your human rights for granted and use your freedom of speech and democratic rights to a free people who could have been you?" It's just a beautiful letter from Yasmin, a classmate of Rehana, who is now a criminal defense attorney. I urge you, my listeners, to continue speaking out for Rehana on your Facebook page. Continue signing the petition. Continue praying. This is a fight that will not cease. We will not give up because Rehana is innocent. She deserves freedom. She deserves pardon. And we will not give up the fight. And you can stay tuned to my Facebook page and my radio program. I will keep you updated in this very grave and critical situation. What I want to talk about before Zainab comes on is some of the subjects that we're going to address in our interview. And one of them is the treatment of women by the brutal group ISIS. And we've heard about ISIS and Ebola in the news. Most of us are panicked and frightened by all of this. And I want you to hear the testimony of a young Yazidi woman who was raped by ISIS right here on the cross in the desert.
Inside this refugee tent in the stifling heat, Aria, not her real name, goes about her daily chores. This is not a burden, but rather a distraction from what this 15-year-old Yazidi has suffered and endured. She asks her parents to leave. She doesn't want to talk about what happened to her in front of them. 6 weeks ago, the family fled their home in Sinjar, northern Iraq, as ISIS stormed in. A convoy of vehicles with black flags drove past them. Minutes later, they were surrounded. "They forced us out of the car," explains Aria. "The girls and women were separated from the men, but they only took the girls, forcing us into a minivan." From Sinjar, Aria says they were driven 120 kilometres to the ISIS stronghold of Mosul and locked in a three-storey house with dozens of other teenage girls who'd been captured. For more than 3 weeks, they were kept here. During this time, a sheikh came and collected 20 girls, including her 14-year-old sister-in-law. "He forced himself on her. I was so scared. A lot of my friends were raped. It's hard to talk about it." Sexual abuse is a taboo subject in this culture, and to admit being a victim is unheard of. And while Aria claims she wasn't raped, this visibly traumatized girl has been through much more than she's willing to admit. I see their faces all the time. I have nightmares. I can't stop thinking about how they force themselves onto the girls. I have seen and been through too much. Aria's story is just one story in one tent among the thousands here. And there is a growing body of evidence of the crimes being committed by ISIS against Yazidi girls and women, aimed at shattering and tearing apart these communities. Aria and her friend were taken to Fallujah by two ISIS militants she calls Abu Hassan and Abu Jaffa. They forced us to marry them, threatening to hurt us if we didn't. They gave us a phone to call our families to tell them we'd converted. Aria says they secretly called her friend's uncle, who knew people in Fallujah, prepared to help. When the militants left the house, the girls dressed in niqabs escaped to a safe house. I never thought I would be freed from ISIS. I'm happy to be with my mother and father, but I found out my brother was killed. ISIS shot him when they took me. Everyone at this camp knows what happened to Aria, but her shame is dwarfed by her guilt after learning what her freedom meant to the other girls. They raped them as punishment because we escaped. They tightened security so no girls can escape anymore. Anna Corrin, CNN, Hunker Refugee Camp, Northern Iraq.
It is horrific to sit and listen to this, but this is what ISIS is doing. They're engaging in sexual slavery, selling Yazidis on the marketplace. And they say they're justifying their use of force and the way they treat women according to Sharia law. And this is unacceptable. Human rights groups all over the world are screaming and yelling about the way they are treating, raping, and torturing people, especially women. And we're going to talk more about this when Zainab comes on. One of the subjects that is dealt with in the documentary film Honor Diaries is female genital mutilation. You may not really know a whole lot about this, but we're going to learn about it through the stories of those who have endured the intense, humiliating, and physical pain of female genital mutilation. I want you to hear their testimony right now on the cross in the desert.
Isatou Kramar and Renata Barod grew up together in Gambia and moved to Britain in their early teens. Now they take care of each other's kids, live in the same London neighborhood, and keep each other's secrets, including this memory from their childhood in Gambia.
They told me I was going to a hotel, I was going to have a fun day in the swimming pool. I've never been in the swimming pool at that age or anything. So I was really excited. They told me I was going to have ice cream. And we just ended up in this grotty house there. and there was loads of other kids there. And you could hear the screams coming through. And then they do it so quickly, and I can't describe it. The worst part of it was when you have to go and squat. They made a little hole on the ground and you have to go and squat in it so the blood can come out. I find that really disgusting because there's other kids next to you as well crying. Mm. When you go up there, you just think that's normal, you know, and then you just find out that that's really wrong. No child should ever have to go through that.
Isatou was 7 when she was cut, her clitoris excised and labia removed. Her cousin Renata was 2 years old. She has this photo of herself in ceremonial dress on the day she was cut, crying.
What hurts me the most is the fact that we were never given a choice. You know, like, we were never allowed to grow up and be asked if we wanted it done. It was done against our own will, and I kind of feel that's like a child abuse.
In Gambia, more than 70% of women are believed to have been circumcised, an act so horrific it's often called female genital mutilation. Women who endure the ritual often suffer lifelong pain during sex, childbirth, or even urination.
You feel like you're not a woman. You know, you don't feel complete because there's something there that's missing that should have been there and that should have never been taken away. But it has. So... That's just really hard.
Yeah.
And it's kind of embarrassing because you want to talk about it to your friends.
And in the pain of childbirth, many relive the trauma of being cut.
You have to relive it all over again because you feel that same pain that you felt there before when it was cut. So I didn't want to go through that again. So I chose to have a cesarean with my second child.
Both have their own daughters now, and they are adamant that the practice must stop.
I was like, there's no way anyone's doing that to my daughter, and if they do, I'll make sure they go to prison for it. And at first she's like, oh, you guys are like, you've taken up the culture here so much, you're African, this is our culture, we found it here, we have to continue it. And I was like, no, Mom, not with me.
A painful tradition that for these two women ends with them. Atika Schubert, CNN, London.
It's unspeakable horror. I can't even imagine it, female circumcision. But this is one of the practices that the movie documentary film Honor Diaries addresses, and we will be talking about that a little bit later. You may think it's just limited to places like Gambia, but you would be surprised and shocked how many of these things take place in the UK. And this is a special report right now on the Cross in the Desert that will inform and educate you.
A sensitive issue which has become a growing concern here in the UK in recent times is the act of female genital mutilation, otherwise known as female circumcision. This procedure, which traditionally practiced as a cultural ritual among African, Asian, Middle Eastern communities, involves the brutal removal of the external female genitalia for non-medical reasons. This barbaric act is rooted in gender inequality and is used as a means to control a woman's sexuality, also as a purifying practice. This is carried out on girls as young as a few weeks old up until puberty, so around the age of 15. Although this practice is most common in Africa and the Middle East, shocking statistics have revealed that at least 66,000 girls and women in the UK are believed to be victims of female genital mutilation. A huge surge in public campaigning has recently brought the issue of FGM into the limelight. And in March this year, two doctors have been charged for carrying out the practice in the London Whittingdale Hospital back in November 2012. Female genital mutilation has been illegal in the UK since 1985, but this recent case is the first where criminal action has been taken against an alleged perpetrator. Now here in the capital, since 2009, 4,000 women and girls have been submitted to London hospitals with side effects of this act. These women aren't receiving justice for the brutal treatment they have received in the past. Unless, as a country, we can bring greater attention to this issue and encourage women to come forward and report these crimes, then they will continue to suffer in silence. As a society, we tend to close our eyes and our ears when we hear of such brutal things. But it is so important that we listen, we research, and we learn more about the problems associated with female genital mutilation. And through speaking more openly about such a stigmatized issue, we can reach out to those who are too afraid to do so themselves.
Say something, I'm giving up on you.
Yes, you can see and hear from this short piece. This horrific practice takes place in more indigenous countries. In places like Africa, it's even being practiced in the UK. There needs to be laws against this. This is demeaning. It's destructive. It's horrific against women. It's unthinkable. I can't think of enough adjectives to describe how horrible this really is. And women should not have to suffer in silence. In fact, my good friend Saba, speaking about silence, has broken the silence. She's been a guest on my program several times, and she stands up for the rights of women as well, all over the globe, and she has broken the silence about honor killings. She has screened the movie Honor Diaries and, as a result, has suffered much persecution from her own Islamic community. Saba is a British Muslim. And so when I think of women suffering in silence, I can say that there are women that are standing up and speaking out for the first time. You know that we have the internet and this technology, and there is no reason that women should have to suffer in silence. that we can give them a voice. The internet gives them a voice, their Facebook page, their Twitter account. We have the technology now that people are coming out of their silence and out of their fear, and for the first time speaking out against these atrocities. And a great example of this, of course, is Honor Diaries. What I want you to hear right now, I want you to hear a short clip from the documentary film Honor Diaries so you can understand what our subject matter is going to be about today on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
My sister was telling me how unhappy she was in her marriage, and I said to her, come to me. She said, I can't, because I have to think about honor. She didn't want to dishonor the family by leaving her husband. In the end, she set herself on fire. Rabina did, and she died.
The concept of honor, it's very difficult to explain it to Western societies.
Honor is something that is carried and contained in women and is there to be guarded by men.
Anything from wearing short sleeves, refusing to wear a headscarf, being seen talking to a man,
those things can be deemed dishonorable.
Thousands of women have been detained for dressing un-Islamically. Like this woman screaming as she's pushed into a police car.
The honor system in Muslim-majority societies is really the basis of a lot of harm that is perpetuated against women.
It's systematic, institutionalized misogyny.
I was crying and begging him to stop. Then he put his hand on my mouth like this. I couldn't breathe. I was crying. But he used me anyway.
The issue of forced marriages, child marriage, and honor abuse is a worldwide problem.
When you do dissent with what is portrayed as mainstream belief, you are ostracized. There are threats of murder, there are threats of rape, physical mutilation.
It's important to talk about what happens physically so that every human being, male and female, understand that the genitals of the female are cut.
We don't need sympathy, empathy, pity. We need systematic change in the Muslim world.
From Bahrain to Egypt, women have raised their voices and their fists in demanding universal rights.
People of all backgrounds can make a difference.
My sisters in solidarity, there has never been a better time than now to turn the tide.
We need a whole army of women helping other women.
We will speak up for our rights and we will bring change to our world.
Honor Diaries is one of the most powerful documentaries I have seen. It addresses these subjects, and these dedicated activists on the film, one of them Zainab Khan, the other is Raquel Saraswati, a Muslim lady, and also a Christian, Nazanin and Afshin Jam and others, stand up and address these issues and educate us on what we can do to make a difference. Women, again, should never have to suffer in silence. Zainab Khan, my upcoming guest, wrote an article just a couple of days ago on World Pulse dealing with domestic violence and honor violence, distinguishing between the two because there are differences, and she will talk about that. But again, you might ask the question, what in the world is honor abuse? Well, it's a system set at the discretion of cultural and societal norms that perpetuate violence against women through systematic and institutionalized misogyny, that is, the hatred of women. I wanted to introduce to you my very special guest today. Her name is Zainab Khan. She was featured in the movie Honor Diaries, and she is now on the cross in the desert. Welcome to the cross in the desert, Zainab.
Good morning, Randy. Thank you so much for having me.
I was just reading a few quotes from your recent article about honor violence and domestic violence. But before we get into all those details, tell our listeners a little bit about your background and how you became involved in what you do today and with your role in Honor Diaries.
Sure. So I consider myself a global citizen, and these issues and causes have always been very near and dear to me. Especially pertaining to women and girls' rights in the regions of the Middle East. My father was Afghan, and he came here to the States in the 50s so that his children can have the freedom, the liberty, the dignity of life that he foresaw he wouldn't have had he lived. And so what we're seeing now, and I believe this is through transparency, through digital media, through activism, through outreach, and through just general, worry about what is actually going on with women and girls in these regions, we have been able to take a stand and take part in a revolution to talk about some of these issues that are centuries old, that have been too taboo to discuss, where there is severe social repercussions and consequences to speak out. And this is essentially where that led. Now, I was part of the film Honor Diaries, which was the first film to break the silence on honor-based violence against women, especially in Muslim-majority societies. And these were, so I had the opportunity of partaking in this film with 9 other women that are staunch activists and supporters for universal human rights from all different generations, different parts of the world. And the lowest common denominator that we all had was the issue of honor-based violence that is inflicted upon women and girls in the name of religion or culture.
It's a powerful film, Zainab, and I'm so glad this film was made at such a time as this, because when I was playing some sound bites before you came on, the common word that kept coming across these sound bites was women suffering in silence. And Honor Diaries gives a platform for women to no longer suffer in silence, but really speak out and get the message out and educate us. And that's what your
Absolutely.
Part was in the film.
Absolutely. And these, you know, the term honor-based violence, now what we're talking about here are really, really atrocious acts such as, you know, child marriage, forced marriages, female genital mutilation, anything that has to do with a woman that is not within the, construed guidelines of what her roles and behaviors should be within a cultural context. If those are violated, then the repercussions are sometimes fatal. And we've been seeing a rise in honor-based violence in the U.S. and in the U.K. Within the past 10 years. And I think this calls to light for us to be able to honestly discuss these issues without brushing it under a rug or without deflecting from the core issue of why these acts are heightened and why it's still continuing.
These acts are perpetuated within a generation of families. The expectations of the daughter doesn't meet with her approval, her dating, her career choices can result in honor violence. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. I think what you do is you bring up a very critical point in that it is collective in nature. And many times it's not just an abuser and a victim, it's an entire extended family that incites or assists in carrying out this abuse. It is collective. It is sometimes an entire community that is, you know, pressured to impose this type of violation against the woman who may, you know, break the rules of what an honor system or honor code is.
Just a few months ago, Zainab, back in May, there was a Pakistani woman, I think her name is Pervana, and she chose to marry a man outside of the family's wishes, and the family confronted them and expected her to pay a sum of money and they would somehow forget this, and they were unable to do so. And a few days later, they were going to the courthouse and the family itself met them there and stoned her. And this is a common practice that goes on in a place like Pakistan.
And that was in Lahore, which is a very urban city, apparently. And it was done in broad daylight where they stoned the woman to death.
Mm-hmm. What can
and then we
do?
Think, then we think, what are we doing? How are we allowing this? How many other cases like Farzana's are going to go brushed under the rug? Or even that we don't even hear about?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the UK a few seconds ago, and I, before you came on, was playing a little special report, and I was really amazed that this practice of female genital mutilation takes place in a place like the UK. It's not just limited to places like in Africa, and I was amazed that this goes on. Tell us a little bit about the horrific practice and kind of fill us in and help us understand what's going on here and why.
Absolutely. Randy, FGM is not just an African problem. It's not just a third world problem. It's not something that just happens over there. It happens, and it's happening here in the U.S. In the United States alone, over 200,000 women and girls are at risk yearly for being victims of FGM. And this crime is committed by either sending the girls overseas or undercover on U.S. soil. And the most shocking part about this is that very few states prosecute the parent or the guardian of these girls or the mutilator performing the crime. So there's little to no legislative protection that is being offered to these girls that are at risk of being sent abroad to be mutilated. And I believe that in the name of cultural sensitivity, heads have been turned against these victims who are subjected to this crime. And there's very little to no resources to provide care for their survivors or safeguard those who are at risk.
Mm. I just think it's horrific. I can't believe it. I can't picture this. It's an attempt by a family to control the woman's sexuality. And the operative word here is the family is involved in controlling. There is very little choice. It is all predetermined. And this is absolutely against any kind of free will that we have as human beings. It's inhumane.
Exactly. Exactly. Where is free will? Where is choice? That is what is missing. Free will, the ability to choose how you want to live your life, where you want to live your life, who you marry, whether or not you want to, whatever your sexuality is, it's controlled. Everything is controlled. And if it is
exactly
not within the guidelines of that, that's pre-approved, then you are in the wrong and you have to pay the price.
Mm. You had a very insightful article on honor-based violence as compared with domestic violence. And since we're talking about honor, I like the points that you made to help us understand the mindset of people that do this. If someone has a boyfriend that the family doesn't agree with, or they reject a forced marriage, or pregnancy outside of the marriage, or interfaith relationship, or they seek a divorce, or they inappropriately dress and wear makeup, the woman is deemed to be westernized, and this is when these crimes are committed. So if a woman decides on her own to choose her own destiny, she is at risk for this crime.
Exactly. And all the points that you had stated, those are key indicators that are inclusive of honor-based violence. And these are, they are implemented to protect either the family reputation, which is essentially the basis of honor-based violence, and this stems from social, cultural, and religious values.
I was sitting here thinking about what you're describing, and I was thinking about our friend in common, Saba, who just recently, and she lives near where I live here, at her
mm-hmm.
university had a screening of the movie, of the documentary you were involved with, Honor Diaries. And as she advertised it, she had to hide it from her brother, who also attends university there, because he would have some real problems with that. And her mother is very concerned that this can cost her life, that this is a danger to her life. And the thing that she shared with us on the program, Zainab, was that the Muslim community was outraged that she would dare to show a film and speak out against this. I just can't understand if the Islamic community has nothing to hide. They should be joining in the fight with us to speak out against these atrocities, shouldn't they?
I absolutely agree. And if these are 9 Muslim women that are telling the story, very objective stories, you can't argue with them because they're facts, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is the need for the backlash? How are we even able to address these issues if we're not able to openly speak about them? And that it perpetuates silence, it perpetuates hypocrisy, is about brushing under the rug and not being proactive in our solutions. Instead, we're reactive. And we are getting angry at the messenger rather than the source of the issue. And this is something that I believe that Muslim communities, especially in the U.S., should take a stand for and be open to criticism in regards to what is happening within their society, not just over in regions of the Middle East, but here in the U.S.
Yes, this is a human rights issue, Zainab, that affects all of us. And so we should be willing to face this problem, as you say, and be willing to make the corrections so that women can once again live in peace and make choices. And this is a very important month for all of us here. It's National Domestic Violence Awareness Month, as you mentioned in your article. Tell me, you have an upcoming speaking engagement, and you're going to be talking about these issues. Tell me, when you go out to do your lecturing and you talk about honor diaries and things, what is your main message to the audience?
Oh, well, my main message always is to be objective and to listen, to be actively listening with open ears without a slapdash response of defense, and being able to democratically, openly discuss these issues. See, this is where the problem is, Randy, is that you had gave the perfect example of this young lady named Saba who has strong intentions. She probably has very, very strong experiences within her community. She's speaking out because she believes in the cause and she believes that no woman should be subjugated or oppressed. And yet, it's a flip. It's a reverse. She is dealt with backlash. She has dealt with the consequences of speaking out. She is probably isolated from her community. She probably feels that she is standing alone in this fight. And this is what we don't want. This is a complete injustice to the women who have suffered, who have survived this type of violence. And this is also going to be an injustice to the very girls who are probably going to be victims of such crimes. So essentially, you're feeding back into the violence by these kinds of reactions. So my goal always is to have an open, honest, democratic dialogue. It's critical, because what you see is when there's backlash or when there's, you know, huge responses that are very, very negative in regards to speaking out. You know, the perfect example also I can say is when back in April, when Honor Diaries was being screened at some universities, CARE had tried to shut down screenings of film. And what good does that do? We live in a society where we have freedom of expression and speech. So if we are not able to openly discuss in our platform, in our given context, then where are we supposed to?
Yes, I think the problem comes back to political correctness once again. It's once again pushing it under the rug. It's not addressing the issue, as you pointed out, and we need to be educated so that women don't have to suffer in silence anymore. Some of the reactions that Saba told me that she had for those that did attend the screening, they were horrified and shocked. When you're out speaking and you're out talking about this issue, do you find a lot of those that listen to you are really unaware or horrified and shocked about really what's happening?
Yes, Randy. And not only that, but I have something very powerful to share with you. I've done screenings throughout the U.S. I have spoken on multiple conferences, panels, screenings, and I was recently in London, and we had held a film screening called Bastards, which was about illegitimate children in Morocco that were born to women who were forced to marry as underage brides but did not have the proper documentation that they were married, because the marriages were done under religious pretext, right? And so you have such awful, awful conditions that are imposed against a woman in that part of the world. You can't even imagine. And after the screening, there were two women that came up to me and said, "This happened to me." And say that maybe 9 out of 10 times out of screenings or panels or events or any conferences or any sort of dialogue that I carry on, at least someone always comes up to me and says, this happened to me. And now watching this and seeing this, I can speak out. And how do I get involved? How do I share my story so it doesn't happen to somebody else? And this is what people need to understand, is that this is the power of arts, of film, of transparent dialogue, when we are able to share each other's stories and actually take action so that it doesn't occur anymore.
That's great. That's amazing, because Saba said something to me, too, that she's always being criticized by her own community. She says, Randy, all I want to be is like the ripple in the ocean that shares this story with someone, and someone takes action and does something, just as you shared with me. This ripple effect is so important, and that someone can hear your story and say, I identify with this, and I can do something. And this is what we're trying to do, is a ripple effect of getting these stories out and taking action. It's education and responsibility together.
Absolutely. And you don't know who is suffering in silence in that audience. You really don't know. Because there is so much taboo, because there is so much, it's so deeply ingrained not to speak out, that you will be violating some sort of code of conduct if you speak out against this, that many, many women suffer in silence. And we need to have these dialogues, these screenings, these discussions, in order to even just scratch the surface of what may be going on.
Exactly. Now, I just want to shift gears here a little bit. I wanted to talk about what's predominant in the news as related to our subjects. About a couple of months ago, one of the ladies that was also in the film, that's a friend of yours, Raquel, mentioned on Facebook that there was a sympathizer with ISIS that was threatening her life because of who she was and what she was doing. And so we see that even in the internet threats. But ISIS has become predominant in the news, and we hear all over the world what they're doing, especially in this report I had before I had you on, that they have gone into some of the communities in Iraq, have captured many Yazidis, and have sold them on the marketplace into sexual slavery, and they've raped many of them. And now they claim they're doing this, and it's justified by Sharia law. Your thoughts on this?
It's awful. Oh, my gosh. I mean, you have to be the demon to really think that that is justifiable. But unfortunately, what you are seeing with ISIS, which is also the same ideologies that are supported by Boko Haram and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, is that these behaviors are justified under their Sharia law and under their interpretation of what is allowed in Islamic law. That is their basis. They are going by the text. And I think this is a wake-up call for not just Muslims here, worldwide. That's the problem. Address that. Don't lash at the people that are bringing these issues up. Go directly to the source.
Exactly. Which brings me
to
my
question. Go
directly
to the source. March back and take all of those, take all of your, you know, because this is what I see also, Randy, is that people get defensive. Religion is a hot topic. It riles buttons. People are very, very defensive about that. This isn't about your belief system versus my belief system versus this belief system. Let's talk about human rights.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about, because to me, universal human rights trumps anything. So if you are justifying marrying girls off, kidnapping. I don't even want to say the word marriage, because essentially it's rape and kidnap.
Yes.
You're raping and kidnapping girls. You are recruiting these women. There was also a story on CNN very recently about a woman that was recruited for ISIS, you know, because it was her survival mode, and she thought she was going to get food and shelter, but, you know, was subjugated to violence within that group, within joining. So We have this tendency to get very hot and bothered and very defensive the minute we say, oh, it's being done under the context of religion. Well, it is.
The hot button issue is religion, Zainab, and that's where we have to get beyond, because it's about humanity, it's about human rights, And all of the emotions, the feelings, and all the backlash comes because of the religious issue. We have to go deeper, though, and you're right about that. What can we do? This is the operative question. What can we do? I've seen honor diaries. Many people have seen it, and hopefully many, many more people should see this very powerful documentary. What now can we do to make a change so that women cannot and do not have to suffer in silence? What are the things that you and I can do, or the average listener that's listening right now and says, I just want to get involved somehow?
I think we really need to hit it home with the laws that are implemented there. That's really where you're going to see actual change, tangible change happen. Because right now, the way that Sharia law also is in many areas of this part of the world is that it promotes the subjugation and oppression of women. You can argue back and forth that, no, this, I'm not talking about the history of the religion or what rights women have. I am talking in the here and now, what the law supports and what is going on. And this is where we need to lobby for change. We need secular laws that are going to protect universal human rights, regardless of your gender, regardless of your religion, so that you are able to be a safe citizen in whichever region, country that you live in. So your basic human rights, your right to believe in whatever you want to, your right to choose when you want to marry, your right to free will is not violated by religiously imposed laws.
These laws and these traditions in certain countries can take a long time through legislative process to overturn, and they can be long and drawn up, but we need to do it.
Yeah, and they can also regress very, very fast, you know. If you look at the perfect example of a place like, you know, Iran or, you know, even Turkey historically, it's very quick. Regression can happen overnight. And this is where we need to be very careful that we truly understand the importance of democracy, of secularism, and we implement them in the name of human rights. This is in the name of humanity. This is to ensure that your people can live safely, can have freedom. And this goes beyond gender. This goes beyond a woman. This is for both, for everyone.
Exactly. I completely agree with that. Now, one of the facets about who you are, Zainab, multi-talented lady that you are, that you also are a painter, a visual artist, and I've seen some of your examples, really good paintings of Jesus, of Mother Teresa, and just recently Malala. You mix art with activism. Share with us what that's all about and tell us how that helps your cause.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for covering this up, Randy. I will actually be delivering a TED Talk November 7th in Chicago about the power of art and activism. And me, I have used my art for various organizations and campaigns to help them raise funds for whatever work they are doing. And I have, you know, beyond painting, I believe, you know, which is why Honor Diaries very near and dear to my heart. Also, the power of art, the power of film, the power of poetry, the power of this type of communication can really become an action item and a tool for social justice. So this is kind of a new way of taking action, of raising awareness, of raising funds, you know, even working within our local, you know, global change begins with local impact. So starting from the grassroots level, with the communities that I'm involved with here in Chicagoland, I share my art, I hold exhibitions, I hold, you know, gallery discussions, and the conversation leads on. And there's always going to be somebody that's in that room that will take something and then carry it over. And that's kind of that ripple effect that you were talking about earlier, that young lady Saba had mentioned. So I hope with art and activism, a new ripple wave can be created, and that we are able to make it work so it's useful and part of our everyday lives.
Amen. I agree with that. Now, one of the paintings that you worked hard on, I think you went through three times, as you mentioned, was Malala. And just recently, Malala shared the Nobel Peace Prize. It was one of the happiest moments of my life. I know you admire her so much. Tell us a little bit about that painting and share with us about what Malala and what she does means for you and for the world.
Absolutely. So I had painted, the first painting I made of Malala was the original one with the dark green background and the red scarf. And that portrait was actually used to raise funds for Malala Fund and the work that they do. And I used the colors from, you know, I used Mark Seligman's photo from Time magazine of Malala, and then I put the colors, I painted it in the colors of the very famous Afghan woman photograph in National Geographic, just simply because the colors were so striking. And to me, those two images hit very near and dear, you know, to my heart. And so that was the first version. The second version I had made was more surreal, and that was used to help raise funds for women and girls organizations in the UK that are working with domestic violence survivors. The very recent painting that I made of Malala is a little bit more of a modern version, and that was painted for YWCA Chicago, where their Leaders Luncheon Award will be October 30th. And I am very honored and to be awarded their award for racial and social justice. So this painting will serve to help raise funds for their amazing programs and activities in the Chicagoland area.
Great. Congratulations.
Thank you. Anything, it's always very humbling to know that something on canvas can really make an impact and deliver and touch the lives of so many people.
Well, you have found a way to take your platform in so many facets. I'm amazed how you do it. And when you can invest it in art, this is a visual connection with people. People love visual things. They can look at that and they are reminded of what that means, what that stands for, and what you're saying. And it's amazing. I really commend you for that. For those in our audience that would love to connect with you, would love to have you speak or where they're at, how can they get in touch with you?
They can send me an email. It is info@zainabzaid.com, and I can share the email address with you. And then you can also connect on Twitter. We can connect on via web. And I just, you know, I believe social media has been a very powerful platform for all of us to connect and share our stories. So I am active on there and can be reached through there.
Fantastic. I really commend you because you have a purpose in your life. You've dedicated your life to make a difference. Gender equality, women's rights, women don't have to suffer in silence. And I want to thank you, Zainab, for being a really powerful voice in the community, in the world, for this issue. Thank you so much for your time and spending with me this morning on the cross in the desert.
Thank you, Randy. It was a pleasure. And thank you so much for always covering these imperative issues, because if we didn't have people such as yourself, we really wouldn't be able to gain any momentum or awareness on a lot of these issues that you cover.
I appreciate that. Thank you. It is my pleasure. And please come back again and share what is happening, and we'll keep in touch with you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
God bless you. That is Zainab Khan, a tremendous lady in so many ways that is making a difference in the lives of women. You see, that's what this is all about. She's taking her talents, her gifts, and she's making a statement. She's using the power of media, social media, which is the best way today. But as she shared with us today, it's also about changing laws. And all of us can do something with that. We can send emails. We can protest. We can use whatever gifts we have. Maybe something Zainab said this morning will just spark something in you and say, you know what, I have this ability. I can do something. I can make a difference. Be that ripple in the ocean for change. This is so important. I want to play for you a song right now. I want to dedicate this to the women of the world that have suffered in silence for the many, many crimes committed against them. It's a reminder of God's unconditional love for you. And this is a song from a few years ago by a band called The Cry. It's called He Won't Let You Go, right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen together. a very moving song from a band known as The Cry, He Won't Let You Go. A song that reminds us that the unconditional love of God can heal the scars in our life. He won't let you go means exactly what it says. There is nothing that you and I could ever do that can separate us from the love of God. I love the Bible verse, Romans 8:38-39. I'm convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor any other thing in the created universe can separate us from the love of God. And that song says an awful lot just about that. This morning we've talked about violence against women. And speaking of that, I go back to Iran. This is an item I wanted to share with you. The Iranian regime's parliament endorsed a bill on Wednesday that legalizes suppression of Iranian women and youth by paramilitary forces patrolling in public places, especially the streets of Tehran, under the pretext of promotion of virtue and prevention of vice. It's amazing how they justify these things. In an overwhelming vote, so-called MPs granted greater powers to groups to promote virtue and prevent vice on the street. The law places these thugs under the Basiji. The Basiji are the paramilitary men controlled by the Revolutionary Guards, and they're responsible for violent crackdown on any expression of dissent in the country. A section of the new bill states, quote, those who would act against controllers will be severely punished. Moreover, this law allows supporters of the plan to protest outside government buildings where women working in these buildings would wear non-compliant clothing. The bill passed in the regime's parliament with 156 votes, 23 votes against and 8 abstentions. It's amazing what this bill will do. It allows the paramilitary to go to government buildings. If they suspect a woman that's not complying with the Islamic dress code, they can protest that out there. The mission is harassing people, basically, especially women and young people, under the pretext of not being dressed properly. So they're going to be harassed. You know, they have the Ghasti or Shad that patrols the streets of Iran all the time. It's what I wrote in my book, The Rose of Nowruz, what the Ghasti or Shad does. And if you're not wearing the hijab properly, you're showing too much skin. Fingernail polish, makeup, that's taboo. You can be fined, arrested. In some cases, you're sent to classes to get your behavior to conform to what the dress code. You actually have to go to classes as people getting reprogrammed to think correctly. And you can be publicly lashed as well. This is harassment, and this is just victimization going on here. And what goes on is that this new bill increases the patrols, the besiegees, that continues the harassment of women. It's promoting much more. It's really the cause of violence and protests in Iran. They are enacting this bill, and they're making life just that much more harder on the young people of Iran. And so this group involved in this bill is once again an example of what's going on. Just a few months ago, you heard about the Happy Iranians. Remember the Pharrell Williams song, Happy, that the Iranians loved, and they made a video. They wanted to say to the world, look, in spite of the problems here, we're really happy. And so they got up on the rooftops of Tehran, and they dressed up like those in the original video, and they danced. They had a great time just expressing joy and happiness, right? They were arrested for that. And they are now serving a sentence. Here's what it is. They have to live an exemplary life, or the sentence will be carried out upon them, which is public lashing and other things. So I found this amazing, this video that went viral on YouTube, and they're suffering because of this. And therefore, I wrote a blog called Happiness is a Crime in Iran. It really is. And so you're not allowed to express joy and happiness. And so I said, I have to dig deeper about this. I mean, okay, they violated the dress code in this video. There was men dancing with women. That's a violation of the code in Iran. You can't do that. But I thought that the whole concept of happiness, there's something deeper going on here. What it is that every December, Ashura, it's mourning the death of Ali, who was killed in a battle, one of the imams, right? And you're supposed to mourn and be sad for what happened to him. Well, there is a cultural norm in Iran about mourning for the imams, mourning. There is a constant need to be sad about them. because of the religion there. And so that's why I feel like that this goes deeper, that happiness is a crime in Iran, not because they violated the dress code as well, but because they're happy. And that's something that they don't want them to be. It's sad. It goes on. So, I mean, this bill passed by the parliament, it endorses much more suppression of Iranian women. And it's so very, very sad in a male-dominated society like Iran is. It very much is. Now, there are women that work in jobs, and they are women that excel, and there are women that go to university. But underneath it all, there are things going on. Some of the university courses that were supposed to be given to women have now been given to men. And so there is that oppression going on everywhere in every facet of everything that goes on in Iran. Once in a while, I encounter a few friends that don't like me painting this dark picture of Iran. But nonetheless, I have to say what is real. I have to say what is going on. I have to say what is true. And this is the oppression that my friends go through all the time. I wanted to talk about this issue of sexual slavery just a little bit more. We touched on it in our interview, and I mentioned that ISIS is justifying this use of sexual slavery. I want you to hear this special report right now all about that on the Cross in the Desert.
Once again, we want to welcome our viewers in the United States and around the world. I'm Wolf Blitzer reporting from Washington. We've been hearing a lot about the brutality of ISIS as its fighters rampage across Syria and Iraq. Now in a new edition of the terror group's online magazine, ISIS is justifying its kidnapping of women as sex slaves. The article says, and I'm quoting now, "One should remember that enslaving the families of the infidels and taking their women as concubines is a firmly established aspect of Sharia or Islamic law. This interpretation, by the way, is rejected by the Muslim world as a total perversion of Islam." Let's bring in Tara Maller. She's with the National Securities Program at the New America Foundation, a former CIA military analyst. Tara, thanks very much for joining us. Tell us about this new interpretation of the justification of sex slaves, as you will, saying this is part of Sharia law.
Well, I think it's really interesting. Obviously, the 1.6 billion Muslims in the world would disagree with this perversion of the words of the Quran. And what's actually interesting to me about this is one of the first times we've seen them give a public justification for the behavior, which they've been getting criticism of in the past few weeks. So it shows me that they've found the need to come on defensive, which I think is interesting, because maybe they're feeling like there are people questioning some of their brutal tactics that we've been seeing, and that we've been seeing people in the media focus on over the last month or two.
And so they're saying flatly that if you're a woman and an infidel, meaning a non-Muslim, that you're allowed to be taken and made into a sex slave?
Yes. If you look at the magazine article itself, it actually distinguishes between Muslim woman and non-Muslim woman. If you're a non-Muslim woman, it says you either have to be forced to convert or killed. And if you're a Muslim woman, they're saying that the justification is that this is okay, and this falls within, there's a religious justification for it. So this is in their latest issue of a magazine that's published in, you know, multiple languages, including English. So, you know, they're finding the need to use this as propaganda to show why they're using certain types of tactics.
Is it because we know ISIS is Sunni, and they go against the Shiites? Are they saying Shiites are infidels as well?
Well, they were focused specifically on the Yazidis and Sinjar as part of the article itself. And I believe that what also was interesting about this is you don't see this sort of justification. You haven't seen it traditionally by other groups affiliated with Al-Qaeda. You haven't seen this. I don't recall seeing this type of justification for the treatment of women when I worked on Iraq. So this type of propaganda to justify it, to me, was a fairly new development.
So Yazidis, what about Christians?
I mean, Christians, they said, you know, would be not falling within this category, which you would face either death or trying to force to convert. But to be perfectly honest, I don't see that they would sort of say, no, we're not going to mistreat, you know, non-Muslim women. They're probably going to adopt these tactics, and they have been adopting these tactics across a wide, you know, range of religions and ages.
Tara, thanks very much for coming in. A pretty awful situation over there. Thanks very much, Tara Maller, joining us. Ahead, worry ramping up over the spread of Ebola. The Centers for Disease Control here in the United States is
Well, it's amazing when you listen to how they justify this, and of course that raises the controversy, is this really a practice? Is Islam? We go back and forth and debate it. And as I was listening to that whole article and to that whole interview, I was thinking about some of the things and the questions that I would have if I was talking to Muslims and about the sex slave thing. And okay, so this wasn't traditionally practiced by the Taliban, and the Muslim community is denouncing this. But I've always had a question as to what about a Muslim that changes their religion? Now, if you live in Iran, you can't do that. If you're a Muslim that converts to Christianity, you can face the death penalty. And so my question was, well, is this a teaching of Islam? Or is this a teaching of the Shiites in Iran? Is this something unique to them and it's not true of Muslims all over? Well, one of the questions I always have is, if a Muslim leaves Islam, what can happen? Well, it's called apostasy. And does Islam prescribe the death penalty for Muslims who wish to embrace another religion? Well, it depends on, I guess, you're going to get this word all the time, interpretation. But let me read you some things that I think answer my question, at least for me. Those who turn their back on Islam, to me, are to be executed. This is confirmed by the words and the deeds of Muhammad, I have to say. And the only freedom of belief in Islam is the freedom to become a Muslim. And how do I say that? How do I back that up? Well, I go to the Hadith. The Hadith is the teachings, the sayings, the practices of Muhammad not contained in the Quran. Okay, and here's what it says in Bukhari. The Prophet said, if somebody discards his religion, kill him. Very clearly, if a Muslim discards his religion, kill him. He's quoting what the Prophet says, and this is in the Hadith. Whoever the messenger obeyeth Allah, according to the Quran, Surah chapter 4, verse 80. And so I take that one statement alone. If it says that, I'm very clearly understanding and that's the teaching. Well, what about the Quran? That's the Hadith. There are many Muslims that don't agree with the Hadith. They would say that Allah wrote the Quran. The Hadith is just the word of men. Well, in the Quran, they wish that you should disbelieve as they disbelieve, and then you would be equal. Therefore, take not to yourselves friends of them until they immigrate in the way of God. Then, if they turn their backs, take them and slay them wherever you find them. Take not to yourselves any of them as friend or helper. Notice what it says. If they turn their backs, become apostates, take them and slay them wherever you find them. So there is that written code in the Quran that it is okay to execute a Muslim who leaves an apostate. That's the Quran, Surah chapter 4, verse 89. And, you know, I'm welcome, all Muslims that would disagree with what I read, to tell me where I'm wrong. Because to me, this is not only found in the Hadith, but it's also found in the Quran itself. And I just wanted to clear up that issue as to one of the questions I would have if I'm talking to someone that's a Muslim. Well, I want to take some time right now, and I want to talk about my really good friend Saba. Both Zainab and I were talking, and in the context of our interview, we mentioned Saba, who has taken a very courageous stand to speak out. She's had a screening of Honor Diaries, and I was just moved by her courage. I was just moved by her conviction, and I wrote my newest blog on the Cross in the Desert. It's called Breaking the Silence. And you know, I have had Saba on my show many, many times now, and I was so moved by the way that she is not afraid to stand up for her beliefs, even though that she is persecuted largely by the Muslim community. So what I want to do is spend some time talking about this issue in relationship to what I've been talking about today, violence against women, because this very definitely connects with violence against women. Saba was really only 12 years old when she heard about the first honor killing. A young Muslim girl had been, and when her family found out, they were outraged. Her selfish act had brought shame to the family and the community. In retaliation, the mother tied her hands behind her back and sat on her chest while her brother strangled her to death. After reading this horrifying account, Saba was shocked. What is going on? This is not Islam. My religion is a religion of peace, Saba says. A few years later, in 2004, Saba was exposed to another honor killing, only this one hit way too close to home. She learned that the elder brother of one of her good friends had been murdered. So there is an honor killing that does involve men. It's rare, but they do happen. Unable to keep silent, Saba stopped researching and began speaking out. Well, I first met Saba on Twitter, and since then we've become good friends. I invited her to be a guest on my radio program, The Cross in the Desert. When I learned she was doing a screening of the powerful documentary film On Her Diaries. Saba is a British Muslim with a Pakistani background. Several years ago, she came to the United States and is currently a student at a university studying biology. Yet Saba is much more than just a student pursuing a degree at a university. She is very open-minded, outspoken, and courageous as a Muslim woman who is unafraid to break the silence. When Saba discovered other Muslim women were speaking out against honor killings and injustices committed against women in the Honor Diaries film, she realized that she had an obligation, a duty, to bring awareness to her own community. While most non-Muslim students were shocked by the film, the Muslim community was not. Instead, they were outraged and offended. Saba was called, quote, a devil, an infidel, and was warned that showing this film could even cost her her life. Saba confessed to me on my radio program that her emotions have been like a pendulum swing. Did I do the right thing? Should I really be doing this? The criticism and death threats have resulted in a great emotional toll on my good friend. At times, she has felt lonely and depressed and wondered if she should really be continuing. Yet despite the difficult challenges, Saba has vowed to continue. Quote, I must speak up when I see injustices. I can't save the world, but maybe I can be like a ripple in the ocean. I tell one person, and they in turn will tell someone else. Bringing awareness and education is the passion of Saba's life. She is committed to making a difference in the lives of abused women in Muslim-majority countries. Yet the challenges she faces is not just limited to the Muslim community. Saba faces challenges from her immediate family. While her father doesn't know about her activism, her mother does and is worried about her safety. In addition to that stress, Saba has to hide her screening activities from her brother since he goes to the same university that she does. During our interview, I asked Saba how she felt about ISIS, and she immediately denounced them as monsters and not Muslims. Quote, I wish the ground would swallow up these monsters and take them down to the lowest hell. Good for her for standing up. One of the biggest challenges that Saba faces is the ongoing stereotypes about Muslims that is largely created by the media. She hates the stereotypes that, quote, all Muslims are terrorists, and is saddened by the suggestion that her religion is guilty of oppressing women. Here's what she says. True Muslims, she says, would not oppress women. They cannot do that because our prophet said that we should treat women and children like petals of a flower. Well, I have nothing but admiration and respect for Saba. She is one of the most courageous Muslim women that I've ever met. Despite the numerous threats and the fear of her brother finding out, Saba courageously continues her battle for the rights of abused Muslim women. For Saba, real Islam is a peaceful religion. There is no compulsion in religion, Saba proclaims, quoting from the Quran. At the risk of her life, Saba will continue to speak out and be that ripple in the ocean, bringing education and awareness to everyone who is willing to listen. What Saba is doing is really taught by the Bible. To her Muslim community, she is bringing fear and shame. But to the God of the Bible, she is bringing honor and glory to him through her activism. Proverbs 31:9 instructs us, speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Ensure justice for those being crushed. Yes, speak up for the poor and helpless and see that they get justice. My prayer is that there will be more Sabas who will speak up and not be silenced by fear. Saba has broken the silence, and as a result, many lives will be saved. Amen to that. Breaking the silence, well, isn't that something that's difficult to do, to go against the norm? You know, you've probably been in a situation where fear has motivated you to keep silent, that you shouldn't speak up because it would be offensive. And that word offensive and offended is a word that's like used to silence you. Now, of course, don't get me wrong, we should be respectful in the things that we discuss and we should be respectful in the way we address issues. That doesn't mean we can't get upset, if you will, and get angry in the right word. The Bible says to be angry, don't sin. The greatest example of this would be that when Jesus walked into prayer, there were money changers selling religion, if you will. And this is supposed to be a place of prayer, and Jesus didn't just walk up and say, hey guys, you really shouldn't be doing this. I mean, this is offensive to God. No, Jesus took a whip with him and smashed the tables. The proliferation of religion is something that was evil in his eyes. This was supposed to be a house of prayer, and they've made it into a place of merchandise. So this is an example of being angry, but you're not sinning. Jesus, in righteousness, was standing up for the honor of God, and he didn't attack anyone physically. He got rid of the merchandise and used a whip to do it, to cleanse the temple, but he did it to protect the honor of God. This is a little bit different than what we've been talking about today. The honor we've been talking about today is when parents say, you can't do this or you bring dishonor to our family. You can't date this person. You can't pursue this career. And you don't have a choice. If you do it, you're going to suffer. Well, that's not the same thing. What I'm talking about honor and what Jesus did is righteous indignation when someone, a group of people, are openly defying the law and honor of God. Notice that Jesus never hurt anyone physically, but he made a point. This is to be a house of prayer, and you've made it into a merchandise of thieves. They were doing something that dishonored God openly and profiting from it, and Jesus was saying, you can't do this here. And he made his point, but again, he never hurt anyone physically. No, the point is there is a place for breaking the silence and showing righteous indignation. A great example was my good friend Donya, who was on my program just a few days ago. They stood in front of the White House with their signs, and they had posters saying no to executions in Iran. They never hurt anyone. They simply made an open display and saying this is wrong. They did it in front of the White House to send a message to President Obama. Instead of sitting down to the table with nuclear rights, you need to address human rights, Mr. President. And one of those is that people who are being executed. And they openly displayed righteous indignation against something that's wrong, but they never hurt anyone.
Healing.